Today's House General Government Committee and members of the committee, I'm going to move the end of our agenda to the beginning and would like to move introduction of a couple of committee bills. The first one is LC, let me get it right, 2576. Kara, would you please explain this bill briefly?
I'd be happy to. It was brought to you by the Oregon Library Association. The present situation is that there's a regulation in statute that libraries maintain current spending in order to be eligible for state grants from the state funds. And the problem with that is as Measure 47 and 50 have impacted local governments, public library budgets have been slipping rather than growing. So they've been ineligible to apply for these funds. Should the committee choose to introduce this bill, it would give you an opportunity to look at this problem and see if you'd like to change the present situation.
Committee members, supporting introduction of this bill does not indicate support for the bill for itself. I would just like the bill to be submitted as a committee bill to this committee. Any objections? So ordered. LC 2576. I need to open a work session. Okay, I'm opening a work session on LC 2576 and ask that it be submitted as a committee bill. Any objection? No objection, so ordered, and I'm closing a work session on LC 2576. Next, LC 2775, similar. It's a draft that we're looking at introduction. Kara, you want to tell us about this one?
Again, I'd be happy to. LC 2775 is regarding unclaimed property. Unclaimed property is things such as bank balances, items in safety deposit boxes, paychecks, securities, those types of items that go unclaimed. And after a period of time, by law, banks, organizations, other governments are required to turn those items over to the state for safekeeping until the proper owner or heir is found. That responsibility presently rests with the Department of State Lands. Department of State Lands and the State Treasurer's Office have joined in this effort to ask you to consider introducing this legislation that would move that responsibility to the State Treasurer's Office. The State Treasurer, as you all know, is responsible for financial responsibility over the items, whereas State Lands is about natural resources. So, again, this is your opportunity to introduce legislation to take a look at this situation to see if you'd like to change it in any way.
And again, committee members, supporting introduction as a committee bill does not indicate support for the bill itself. This is a big bill, and I think we'll enjoy hearing it. Any objection to its submission as a committee bill? Submission is so moved, and I'm closing the work session on LC 2775. And at this time, I would like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2253. Kara, you want to describe it? And in the meantime, Harrison Conley from LC is here to tell us a little bit about this.
Well, Harrison will give you more information, but HB 2253 changes the term governmental unit to local governments in a remaining chapter of ORS 223. This provides consistency in statutory language.
Harrison, you want to tell us what this little revisor's bill does?
Yes, Harrison Conley, Deputy Legislative Counsel. Well, I'll give you a little insight, I guess, into the process. Of course, we draft all of your bills, and we spend several months immediately after session integrating new law into the next revised statutes that are published every 2 years. That gives us several opportunities to read these statutes and to recognize when occasionally we get something just a little wrong. In the case of this chapter, we have a defined term, local government. And then over the past couple of sessions, I've had several opportunities to get in this chapter, and we had units of local government, governmental units, all sorts of, I think there were at least five different ways of referencing local governments, political subdivisions of the state. And so over time in this chapter, I've managed to wipe all of those out and bring them all in to be conformed to the defined term. in reviewing this chapter, I recognized that, hey, this is my last section that really needs to be conformed. So we said, why don't we introduce a bill through Legislative Council Committee to do that? In theory, you should virtually never find anything substantive in a bill that we have suggested introducing, and I don't think you'll find that that's the case here. It's just about conforming to the term that we've defined, so we're consistent.
Thank you, Harrison. Any questions, members of the committee? Yes, Representative Buckley.
I don't suppose we could change to our esteemed local governments or just
these. While I'm sitting here and I have two members of LC of our Legislative Council before us, I will say it's nice to see you out of your, you know, where you reside, and thank you for all your efforts, and thank you for what you're doing here and what we know you've been very busy doing. When I've got you face to face, I can't help but say thank you. We are in work session on this.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2253 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and be placed on the consent calendar.
Representative Semner moves House Bill 2253 to the floor with a due pass recommendation to be put on the consent calendar. Any comments or objections? So ordered, and I'm closing the work session on House Bill 2253 and opening a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2259. And going to ask Doug McKean to come up and tell us about this revisor's bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Doug McKean, Deputy Legislative Counsel. Thank you for your kind words. This bill, I'm afraid to say, is here to correct an error made by my office last session. Last session, as you know, we adopted, or you adopted, enacted House Bill 2241, which is the large public contracting bill. That bill repealed ORS Chapter 279, which was the public contracting chapter, and enacted three new chapters, ORS Chapters 279A, 279B, and 279C. What you see in front of you in House Bill 2259 corrects an error in the engrossing between the A engrossed version of that 2003 bill and the B engrossed version. When the Senate, on August 13th, adopted some amendments to the A engrossed version, there was a line in those amendments that said, delete line 14 and insert. Well, in engrossing the B engrossed version, we inserted the new language but failed to delete the line that should have been deleted. So what you see in the amendment in Section 1 of House Bill 2259, the language there that's removed is the language that should have been removed in the B engrossed version of that bill last time. And so without that language, it would read as it should have read and as it should have been printed in the B engrossed version that was later passed. The B engrossed version was voted on and passed by the Senate, later by the House, and so is enacted with this error. So this bill is strictly to take out language that should never have been there before. It has to do with small procurements by public agencies of less than $5,000, and you can kind of read what was taken out in that bill. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Doug on this? I will tell the committee that I remember this. It was large, to say the least, complex, and these kinds of things do happen. Remember, we're about changing statute, and some are very large and complex. Thank you, Doug. Without questions or further discussion, Representative Sumner?
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2259 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Sumner moves House Bill 2259 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any objection? Any comments or objections? So ordered. Members of the committee, I am open to suggestion. I would be putting this on the consent calendar without further objection, then I will. put it, we shall, we don't need a motion to put it on the consent calendar?
I think it was in the motion.
No.
He did not.
No, do you move it to the consent?
I move to consent calendar.
Representative Esquivel moves it to the consent calendar. Any objection? So ordered. And I'm closing the work session and public hearing on House Bill 2259. Okay, thank you. Committee members, now before us, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2157. Kara, this is a new bill. And
like House Bill 2157 is a very interesting measure before you. It provides the way for local government agencies to request state and nationwide fingerprint background checks for persons hired into positions of public trust that deal with sensitive information or material. In this case, computer specialists, financial people, those that deal with hazardous waste and similar jobs. It also streamlines the process for background checks by the state police when requested to do so by an appropriate governmental agency.
Thank you. We have some testimony this morning.
We do.
I'm going to call them in the order that they were put down here. Patricia Whitfield. Thank you for coming.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Chair Berger, members of the committee, good morning. I'm Patricia Whitfield, Director of the Oregon State Police Identification Services Section, and I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2157. It does deal with state and nationwide background checks. There are two purposes for this legislation. First, in Section 1, it does provide a means for local government to request a state and nationwide background check when an ordinance has been passed that requires fingerprints for the purpose of non-criminal justice employment, as mentioned previously by Kara Fisher, for positions within the public trust or security systems, those types of things. Currently, unless the purpose is for law enforcement or criminal justice, there is not a means for local government agencies to gain access to state and nationwide background checks for that purpose without a statute. And this Section 1 of this bill would help accomplish that. Our agency has been contacted by local law enforcement, who in turn have been requested by their local government agencies to perform background checks for them, and they just don't have the authority to do that this time. Section 2 of House Bill 2157 is our attempt to provide a streamlining tool for the background check process. There are several state agencies that currently do background checks through the process, and this bill would help to clean up that process. It would also gain access for agencies that don't have the authority currently to do a background check. And it might also provide agencies to do a nationwide check where they currently only have access for Oregon information. The purpose, again, within Section 2 is to provide a template, so to speak, for the process of the backgrounds requiring the fingerprints, and then allow the agency to address any specific needs they have within their own statutory authority for their agency and through administrative rules. A couple of examples for the cleanup that we feel are important to be addressed are some agencies have passed legislation to do a background check, specifically through the FBI nationwide check, only to find that the nationwide check could not be done because it didn't meet the FBI's requirement. The language in the law didn't pass their standard. The other purpose would be in cases where one agency may have used a specific agency statute that is in law to do a background check, and they use it for their own purposes, but it didn't quite fit. And again, those are just some examples of the cleanup effort to provide a common process to agencies. And sections 3 through 44 are mainly agencies that currently do have access and folding them into this common practice and preserving what access they currently have under their own enabling statute for their specific agency. Because of the interest that we've seen since drafting this bill and the number of agencies that potentially are involved, we have worked with various groups to suggest amendments, and we do support those amendments that will be forthcoming. They were not available for the hearing today, and we believe that they will improve the process further from how it's currently written, and we will continue to take input from agencies. It will allow us to further maintain the confidentiality of the background check process and criminal histories, and some additional cleanup as far as terms and definitions. Again, that will bring some consensus for a common process. And Chair Berger, members of the committee, that completes my testimony, and I would be happy to answer any questions you have, and I thank you for providing me the opportunity to explain this bill.
Thank you. Patricia, I have a couple of questions. So I'm clear in my own mind. Some agencies do these background checks now. Others do, but don't, because of statutory problems, can't get a national check. They can.
That's correct.
And this would take all those agencies and put them in under an umbrella and make a process where they can get these national background checks. Is that?
Chair Berger, yes, that's correct.
Now the question is, does this require the check? In other words, does this statute mandate the check?
Chair Berger, no, it does not mandate the check. The agency would, through their rule, specify which positions, which applicants, which employees, whatever the case may be, would be subject to fingerprinting and subject to a background check.
Okay, and that would be by rule, agency by agency, is that
correct? Yes. Okay. Unless it's specified.
Unless it's statutorily
right.
Required. Representative Cameron.
Thank you. Ms. Whitfield, I had the medical board of examiners in my office the other day saying they can't run background checks on doctors that are coming here because of statute. Does this allow them to do that?
Representative Cameron and Chair Berger, yes, it would provide them to do that. Either they could be mentioned in the amendments, specifically their agency, and it would their enabling agency statute could provide a statement that is a read with to Section 2 of this particular bill that would allow them the process. The language, as it's written, has been approved by the FBI, so we know that would ensure anyone that's using this process would be able to, in fact, conduct a nationwide check if that is their intent. We did learn that they have their own bill, I believe, that they are attempting the same thing, and they would be able to do that either in that bill or this bill, the nationwide check.
You have a follow-up, Representative?
Yeah. How do we get the FBI in here to tell us why we can't? I mean, what are the rules that are being made that prevent us from common sense things that we need to have the latitude to take care of in our agencies? And that's what I asked them. What's the rule that the FBI has that stops us from getting permission from an applicant to do this background check and following through on it?
We have further testimony that may can't come up, but I'll okay.
I'd be happy to answer that. Mm-hmm. Representative Cameron, I guess I do know that question came yesterday. I didn't know who it came from. We had a meeting with the interested parties in this statute or this bill at the same time I think that hearing was taking place. There is a public law, 92544, that allows for fingerprint-based background checks for non-criminal justice employment purposes. And it's very specific that a state must have a statute that requires the fingerprints for that background check to ensure that the person that's being checked on is, in fact, the record that would be returned is based on fingerprints. So it does have a requirement for fingerprints, and the language must meet 92544 requirements, and I believe the medical examiner's current statute does not meet that criteria.
We're bumping up against the feds here. Okay. Further questions? Thank you very much.
We may have further.
I'll be here.
Yeah, if we need you. Larry Abb? Is it Abb or Abe? Abb, I'm sorry. Took us down. Thank you.
Chair Berger, members of the committee, my name is Larry Abb, and I'm the director of the Division of Business Services for the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office. And I wanted to come here and spend a few minutes with you to talk about House Bill 2157 and the impact that it could potentially have with local government and our ability to provide information for public trust on potential employees who or vendors who do business with Multnomah County. The reason I'm here before you is the bulk of the requests for this type of information, fingerprint information, computer-generated criminal justice information, those types of things, in Multnomah County come through the sheriff's office. And so we have we found that we have a high interest and a high need for seeing the adoption of this bill. I'd like to give you just a couple of examples of some of the needs that we have seen come through our office for criminal history information, and I think you'll find that they're very similar to things that are contained in the other sections of the statute. One of the things that we have that is almost that's probably the most frequent is through our tax collection department, where we have people who are put in positions of handling and receiving large amounts of money that come in through our tax collection system, not only through the state property tax, but through the Multnomah County income tax. We do a collection of all of those. These people handle millions of dollars a year for both the state and the county in tax collections, and this statute would allow us to have another tool for assessing the public trust issues that our employees would have. The other areas that we have that are very very frequent are very similar, like I say, to the things in 2157. We have a lot of programs locally within the county that deal with children, elderly, disabled. We employ teachers in different capacities. We have a lot of opportunities for program needs that are both originated in Multnomah County, and in some cases are passed to local government in order to perform some of the things that either enhance or help state programs. So we have a very high need for being able to use this as a tool to help us understand and help us make good decisions on selection of employees and vendors for people doing work for Multnomah County. I sincerely like the idea or the restrictions in the bill that requires destruction of fingerprint cards after the process is over and discussion is made. I think that's a very useful tool to make sure that this is used almost very specifically for the needs of the bill. And I'm also very very much in favor of the enabling ordinance requirements that would allow us to have the public hearing and the process and go through the process to allow us to very specifically and carefully identify those who would fall under these types of statutes. So with that, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Questions? Yes.
Perhaps I should have asked the last person, but I just have a general question about conventions that interest groups were involved in this process and the creation of this bill, and I just wonder if any of those groups were civil liberties groups.
They are going to be speaking.
Oh, okay.
One of them is going to be speaking shortly.
Okay.
I have a process question, if you don't mind. What do you do currently, and how is this going to change it? I mean, that's just nuts and bolts. If somebody comes to you and says, we've just hired a new parks person, would you do a criminal background check at this time?
We would not under the statute, no.
And under this, you would, depending on some other external, or it would authorize you to and someone else would decide whether you do or not?
Well, the way I understand this current draft, we would seek an ordinance through our Board of County Commissioners and very specifically define those people who would be authorized to be the subject of these checks. We're not interested in making a blanket policy for every employee who comes into and applies for Multnomah County. We think it's there are some very legitimate needs for positions of high trust, especially when dealing with children, elderly, disabled. When we're dealing with people who have a high fiduciary responsibility, those types of classifications, it's a very useful and I think necessary tool to help us make those decisions.
And this then would require you to have a very defined set of criteria for when you would use this tool.
Yes, it would.
Okay. Thank you. Question?
Madam Chair, sir, I'd like to know if you would intend to apply this law retroactively. In short, will you be searching the backgrounds of people who are currently holding sensitive positions, or is this just for new hires?
Well, I don't know how the statute reads. We would. I'm speculating now that what we would do is would use the statute only in those circumstances where something other than just employment triggered the need. For example, if some behavior of an existing employee suggested that we might need to look into it, then we might choose to use that if the statute enabled us to do so. If otherwise, it would probably be from this point forward.
Further questions?
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sir, could you tell me if you're hiring someone in a sensitive position who you'll be fingerprinting, is it your intent then to run a nationwide fingerprint check on each person that's fingerprinted?
If they were covered under the enabling ordinance, yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions, Mr. Bob? Thank you very much for coming and talking to us.
Thank you for your time.
Next we have Andrea Meyer from ACLU.
Good morning, Chair Berger, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU. I haven't appeared in front of you at all this session, so it's good to do so. A first wanted to just touch base on a little bit of the history of the development of using fingerprints for nationwide criminal background checks in Oregon law. It's only relatively recently, beginning in the early 90s, and the ACLU was involved and had many concerns. And the focus originally was TSPC, Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, wanting the authority to do it for applicants of teachers, and as well the other agency, Department of Education, for school bus drivers, human resources, for child care centers. It's been, as you'll see in this bill, an increasing creep on this that does concern us. Some of our concerns that we had going in the early 90s, and we worked on and came to agreement on the original laws that were passed in the early 90s on this, were a concern about sending fingerprints off to the FBI of, you know, innocent people. Again, fingerprints is something that is taken when someone is arrested and suspected of a crime. And we consider it rather invasive and personal information and something that the government should have, you know, a reason and a very strong requirement before we just give over our fingerprints. So we were concerned about safeguards regarding the FBI. We were concerned also that people who maybe had committed minor offenses or even major offenses at a very young age might be in some way barred from, simply because of their past history, from moving forward. It would be irrelevant to their job, but we are stopping them from being productive members of society. And then the other concern we had is potentially widening distribution of criminal history information that would make it more, you know, that would get out in a community that someone had a criminal past, because you're talking about obtaining a criminal history on someone. So to address our concerns, back in the early 90s, there was an agreement that in the law, the licensing board commissioner agency in ORA 670.280 may not deny, suspend, or revoke an occupational professional license solely for the reason that the applicant or licensee has been convicted of a crime, but it may consider the relationship of the facts which support the conviction and all intervening circumstances to the specific occupational professional standards in determining the fitness of the person to receive or hold license. In other words, needs to be a strong nexus. It's not simply you committed a crime. So that safeguard was important. Another safeguard that we had put in the bill was to ensure that no permanent records of the fingerprints of law-abiding individuals would be retained by the FBI. Again, if you do a fingerprint background check and the person has a criminal history, their fingerprints are already there. So we're talking about the people who haven't. And we don't want the FBI and we don't want the state government maintaining a database of fingerprints of people who are law-abiding members of our community. And we wanted to ensure also that the FBI's policy at the time remained in place, which is that they return or destroy these fingerprints. And you'll see that in the second page of the bill, the bottom section, it's current law, but I'm just pointing to you to, because this is a cleanup bill. So you'll see section 2 starting on line 33, the language basically saying return or destroy FBI, OSP, agency. And that principle is done. Also, you know, to avoid the widespread dissemination of criminal histories, the original laws required that local school districts for non-certified personnel submitted their fingerprints. The fingerprints were submitted to the Department of Education, and they in turn, because it's the OSP or Oregon State Police that had to do it, the information that came back was given to the Department of Education. It was not given to the local districts. There was this protection against, again, widespread dissemination of this information on someone. Same with licensed teachers. It was TSPC that does the check on this and make sure
that would be Teacher Standards and Practices Commission.
Yes. It is Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, TSPC. Now, I want to also point out another piece of information that may have gotten lost, and I was sort of surprised to learn this. You can actually get a criminal check, not using fingerprints, on any of us in the state of Oregon. I can go in and get it about any of you, and you can go in and get it to me, and if I, and Ms. Whitfield can correct me if I've got this wrong, but I will not know that you have sought that information on me unless apparently there is some information to disclose. In other words, that it comes back with some criminal history information in Oregon. Then I will receive notice that you've asked for that. But otherwise, anyone can do that, including the counties and the cities and local and public and private entities. So there is, now it's not a national check, and it does not require a fingerprint, but there is a basis to determine and get information on someone's criminal history in Oregon without going through the rather invasive use of fingerprints. Now, our position on the bill, and we have been part of the work group, and I do appreciate that the Oregon State Police brought us in early. They know we've been involved in this issue for many years. To the degree that this bill does some cleanup and organizing, we support it. To the degree that it puts some safeguards in, we're very concerned that as an increasing number of agencies and folks have the ability to get the authorization, get the fingerprints, that they need to have the criteria, that nexus, to ensure that the information really relates to, one, the job, and whether a person will or will not get the job because of any criminal background. So there is language that they're working on that will provide more shall language in terms of agencies having rules. The other thing we're concerned about is if an agency has rules, someone needs to be sure ensuring that there's oversight, that these rules have that tight nexus. I think DHS has been doing this for more years, but we've got more and more agencies. You've got a number of bills of various licensing folks that want to do that. There needs to be some oversight of that. Finally, we are really very concerned about Section 1. This opens up, as far as I'm concerned, a bit of Pandora's box. This would be unprecedented in giving local counties and cities and municipalities the authority to pass an ordinance that anyone, basically, who's in their employ or who is a contractor must submit to a fingerprint background check. For instance, in a city hall, someone who delivers the papers or the office supplies would fall under provide services or seeks to provide services to the local government as a contractor, vendor, or volunteer. There is no safeguards. There are no protections in Section 1. It's a local community decides to pass the ordinance, and that would be the check that they'd have to do. They could have it for everyone. Now, I appreciate that the gentleman from Multnomah County said we're really interested in a very narrow field, but we're very uncomfortable leaving that up to every local entity. Some towns are very small. You can get a lot of personal information about people in your community, unintended. It can get out. Many people may have contract or vendor or whatever relationships with local entities. That could sweep in a lot of the community. And we're having the legislature for the first time turn it over to local entities to make that determination, something that you have kept in your purview and have had some checks over the years, ensuring that it's limited. So we're very concerned about that section. We will continue to work with the parties, in particular Oregon State Police, in working to make this law clear. It's been spread out in the statutes. I don't think it's giving the proper guidance to the agencies anymore and ensuring the safeguards are there. And I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Questions for Ms. Meyer? Representative Witt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Andrea, you called our attention to page 2 of the bill, mm-hmm. section 2, lines 33 and 34.
Oh, wait, onward.
Can you tell us how the state of Oregon can obligate the FBI to do anything?
Chair Berger, Representative Witt, it can't. Currently, the FBI has those rules. If you keep reading subsection 5, if the FBI return... wait, I'm sorry, it's somewhere else in here. Let me... And maybe it's right there. It's in that subsection there, lines 35. If the Federal Bureau policy authorizing return or destruction of the fingerprints cards is changed, for instance, if they were no longer to return them, the Department of State Police shall cease to send the cards to the Federal Bureau. So it doesn't it doesn't require, it simply says, as long as that rule that you currently have in terms of not maintaining database of fingerprints of people who have not been convicted of crimes exists, then we will continue to send them to you. I should point out that we've had some conversations with the Oregon State Police. You know, in the old days, it was a card. It was a fingerprint card, and that got mailed off and returned. And now we're using data imaging, if that's the correct term, but the computer technology. And so we are working with the Oregon State Police to kind of determine right now what's going on with the FBI. I think they do have the policies in place, but we are concerned about ensuring that these computer images are truly destroyed and not kept of people who've never been convicted of a crime.
Madam Chair, follow-up.
Yes.
Andrea, are you aware of any obligation that the FBI has to tell the state of Oregon that they change any policy?
Chair Berger, Representative Witt, and I'm sure Ms. Whitfield can talk about this more. I think some of it is premised in law. No, I'm not sure that I know of any obligation of the FBI and that to do that. And so actually that was one of our questions a few weeks ago to the Oregon State Police is, let's revisit what's going on in, with an expansion data mining interests that some have had in the Pentagon and elsewhere of the TIPS program and all the sort of my databasing that's been of interest. But we also, I do believe some of it is premised on federal law, and then there are FBI policies, and we need to make sure that those are kept there and that we monitor them to comply with the law as it's written now.
Thank you.
Further questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Andrea, on Section 7, page 3, line 7 says the rules may include but may not, but need not be limited to a list of criteria to the criminal offender information. As I understand this, this would only cover state agencies. Am I correct by that? Not local government?
Chair Berger, Representative Buckley, let me answer part of that, and then I would suggest maybe Ms. Whitfield come back up because she's more has a more thorough understanding. Yes, I believe that state, city, and local entities are not covered under this, and that as drafted, Section 1 would not bring into it the other provisions and the safeguards. You've actually, as she spotted, one of the things that we've brought up to Oregon State Police, the may use in this language. We are really very uncomfortable, and I think there's some agreement that it should be, one, you shall have rules, because as written, it says, you must have rules, but we aren't going to tell you what they need to include, but they may include the following. Well, if you look at that list, I think we hopefully would all agree that they should include the following, because those local, the state agencies need to have, again, the nexus, the check, the protections, the safeguards. And then we need someone, we're concerned because it says each authorized agency in consultation with the state police shall adopt rules. Well, we need safeguards. We do need someone to make sure, do you have the rules? Are they narrowly tailored, that they comply with the sentiment and the policy behind the legislature's desire to have a limited, you know, have this? And so we would also look to not only changing the may to shall, but ensuring that there is, whether it's the state police that may have someone, is really ensuring that as we expand who can do this, that the licensing boards and others have the criteria, and also that there's a limited release, again, of the information once it's obtained. It's hard. You don't want to say these crimes, thou shalt not get a license, although actually TSPC does have an explicit list in statute of which crimes you do not get a license for, and then I think other language about other factors for other types of crimes may take into account. So they've done that, but that's very narrow, and we would be concerned about doing that because it may really not take into the nuances and the facts of a particular case if it's a crime that occurred 20 years ago versus something that occurred 1 year ago and the rehabilitation and other aspects of it. Long answer to your question.
A very, very good answer to that. I appreciate it.
Good catch, folks.
Madam Chair, at some point I'm wondering if we could bring our previous witness.
I can guarantee you we're going to. Further questions? Ms. Meyer. Yes.
I had a question. I mean, this is in the summary, so but this is more of a just general question. You know, when you talk about positions in the public trust that deal with sensitive information, is there any way to create language that draws anything approaching a bright line in terms of what constitutes a position in, you know, the public trust or sensitive information? Or this is just an attempt so every agency can do this?
Well, Chair Berger, Representative, is it Galizio? Can we come up with bright line language? I don't know. I'd like to look at making it very narrow and clear language. Do we want each agency to then figure out whatever they want to do? that seems problematic. It seems like it's a policy decision in this legislature to have it narrowly tailored. That's what that policy decision was, one that was part of the whole framework of this going forward. And again, in the beginning, it was very limited, and we were, you know, assured it was going to be a very limited world. And as you see this session, you've got lots of people visiting you in your office and others going, we want this information. Well, for what purpose? What safeguards? And all those questions. And so how do we, it is very hard to capture this back into a narrowly tailored, but certainly that's one of our goals, is to do that. And that's why, you know, I'm very troubled by the leaving it to the rules of the agency, because then it's left to the discretion of each agency. And I think we do need some very clear guidance in here about a very strong nexus. And similar to the statute I read to you, 670.280, that needs to be in, that principle needs to be there. It probably can be even tightened more. Because then a check that they have complied with the rules, if they're doing their own rules. That there really is, you follow the rules, you've got a very narrow situation.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I look forward to talking to you folks again about this and any other issues that come before your committee. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Whitfield, would you care to come back up and address some of these issues? And certainly, you don't have to be the definitive answer on everything, but I think
I will try and answer anything that I can. Specifically, so I tried to make some notes here regarding the Section 1 that doesn't have the same type of requirements that Section 2 does. In the amendments that I spoke of that we hope to see soon, we do try to put something similar in that place. And you might want to ask some questions of Mr. Aub of how the cities or the counties would take care of that. I'm not really familiar with the ordinance process and that type of thing, but we do see a need of trying to place that kind of safeguard into Section 1 as well. Section 2, subsection 7, as Andrea mentioned, the word may is there, and we are changing that to shall. And these are the minimums. The agency shall determine these elements. They can add to it, but they need to have those as the basis. We recognize that within the state police, if they are accessing our criminal history record information that we maintain, an agency needs to follow our rules as well, and there are several statutes to protect the confidentiality of criminal histories. When the legislature determines that an agency is authorized and should have this information for the purposes specified, then that agency must go through training and a certification process through our CJIS, Criminal Justice Information System, formerly LEDS, Law Enforcement Data System, to ensure that they know how to use that information, and they can't use it for anything other than the purpose that they requested it. And then it cannot be disseminated to anyone beyond that purpose. And it is the criminal history record information is not to be retained. It is to be destroyed or kept separate from any other records. Section 7 is similar to what is in place in the agencies that currently do have access for criminal history information.
But correct me if I'm wrong, if you don't mind, Section 7 is only concerned with agencies and doesn't include any local government language.
That's correct, Chair Berger, the way that the bill is written currently. Again, we are working with Legislative Council to put something similar in Section 1 that would cover the local government agencies. It's quite a task. We're very open to input on how to best meet that need. Because the local governments have the same types of needs and protection for their businesses and the folks that they work with and for, the same as a state agency. They are just different bodies, and they're treated separately in this particular statute.
If I understand the way this is written currently from previous testimony, and perhaps I'm wrong, and I know I need to read it thoroughly myself, the way it's currently written, the agencies may, and if amended, shall have this Section 7 protection in it, but the local governments will have the same powers but without the protection piece in it.
Right, and it is not written that way. We do hope to have something in the amendments that would take care of that.
Okay. Further questions? Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Chair. Two questions, if that's all right.
That's fine.
Both on appeals and on review. On page 4, top of the page, the appeals process is placed in the personnel rules, policies, collective bargaining provisions of a local government, I would presume. And I'm wondering if there has been discussion of clarity on that process or consistency on that process. Do we have assurances that the local governments do have consistent appeals process that would allow a prospective employee, or in cases as written now, a volunteer or a vendor or contractor, to be able to appeal a criminal background check that might not be accurate, for instance?
And I'm sorry, Representative Buckley, which page was it that you were referring to?
Four, top of the page.
I believe it's that starts. It's the section that starts.
Individuals.
Section 8.
Line 2.
It starts on page 3.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
It starts on 3 and goes into 4.
And then it goes into page 5.
Okay. And that is another area that we are adding to the amendments. I don't know if that answers your question, but the suggestion that in the review process, if someone were denied employment, that it would be based solely on the basis of their criminal history and tighten that down. I'm not familiar with that process because that's what the agencies do. Our role is to provide the criminal history if they're authorized. But most agencies that were involved with the discussions for this bill did think that this was important to have in place and to add some tightening language to it.
Very good. I look forward to that. And my other question is, on review, is there any provision as currently drafted for a report back to the legislature on the use of this, the process, the number of appeals made to state agencies, complaints by citizens, anything that would give us a chance 2 years from now, 4 years from now, to check in and see how this process is working?
I'm not aware of anything, Representative Buckley, that is in place, but we certainly could provide a report. It would be a collective effort because, again, state police might not have all of the information from the individual agencies, but I'm certain we could do that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions? Thank you. Thank you very much. I don't see anyone else who cares to speak today on this particular proposal. Yeah, DAS has provided to the committee a letter in support of this proposal. I will ask that you read it and add it to your packet. Clearly, we will be coming back and hearing more. We have amendments, and I know you and the committee members will be quite proactive in expressing your own desires for what you'd like to see. And in the meantime, thank you very much. Thank you all for coming. And I am going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2157. And there being no further business before the committee, I'm going to adjourn the committee on general government.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.